21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Everybody needs a helping hand. Take a look at your fellow man and tell me what can I do today. Because everybody needs a helping out. If that ain't what it's all about, tell me what. What can I do? What can I do?
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, and Noah Dankner runs our board. Joining us this hour is neurosurgeon Dr. Evan Alexander to share with us his new book, written with Ptolemy Tompkins, The Map of Heaven, How Science, Religion, and Ordinary People Are Proving the Afterlife. In The Map of Heaven, Dr. Alexander shares some of his own and some of the stories that people have told him since release of his New York Times bestseller, Proof of Heaven. In these stories, one finds connections that Evan draws between what spiritual leaders, scientists, and philosophers have long been saying about the journey of the soul in heaven and on earth. Continuing in a long line of other explorers such as Dr. Ian Stevenson, Dr. Raymond Moody, Ingo Swann, and so many other dear friends of ours over the decades reveal, Dr. Alexander's own personal experience proved to him that consciousness is not confined to the body, nor bound by time and space. Consciousness, we know, exists before the body and continues after the body dies. Consciousness is not dependent on the brain. Consciousness is shared between all life force, and we as humans have the capacity to keep in touch with loved ones here, there, and everywhere, as I like to say, because heaven and earth are not separate places, but continuums of experience that all souls have. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Alexander.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, what a lovely sequel to your first book, which I and evidently millions of others have read, Proof of Heaven. I was going to ask you how that book, because it really has opened the door for so many people that despite mine and so many other troopers' best efforts over the last 40 years or so, you really, I call you the poster child of the near-death experience. Your book, Proof of Heaven, really opened a world up for many people. What did it do for you?
Well, it has definitely opened the world for me in tremendous ways. I think the most important thing to put out there is this is all about a tremendous shift that's coming on to our scientific worldview. It has everything to do with the fundamental nature of consciousness. And we're coming to realize, and this, when I say we, I mean a tremendous number of those who are interested in neuroscience and philosophy of mind, coming to realize that our old model that we subscribe to in the 20th century, a brain creates consciousness, fails miserably. And that's what I get into in both Proof of Heaven and now Map of Heaven, is how the scientific landscape is shifting dramatically. And this is really all around a 2,600-year-old debate, the mind-body debate, about the interrelationship of the mind and of consciousness with the physical brain. And it really is a fundamentally world-changing view because of the implications of what happens when we die, when the brain and body die. And this emerging scientific view is one of consciousness as being fundamental in the universe, that it's actually liberated when it's freed from the shackles of the physical brain.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when we look to the indigenous peoples or sacred societies, this is not new. This has always been the teachings in the Hermetic wisdom traditions.
Right. This kind of knowing has been around for probably tens of thousands of years. I mean, it's an ancient knowledge, but the thing that to me was so shocking and awakening about my experience was, you know, as I described in Proof of Heaven, it was a very clear-cut example of how the physical brain does not create consciousness at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I never realized the very rich scientific literature that supports this idea of the brain as a reducing valve or filter or transmitter, but not as the creator of consciousness. And that's where this scientific shift is going to have such fundamental implications for all of this world.
And it'll interesting.
Relate to our very understanding of all of existence, not just kind of the mind and the brain and their relationship. And it's because consciousness is so fundamental to all of human experience. It's really the only thing any one of us truly knows to exist. And once you kind of get into the depths of that and realize that our materialist science has absolutely zero to offer about how physical brain might give rise to consciousness, then you start to see where all this is headed. And it's a very exciting shift indeed. And like you say, it's really kind of an awakening to some of the ancient wisdom that is very much true and rescues our materialist science from the dead ends that it was facing in the enigma of quantum mechanics and in the very hard problem of consciousness itself.
When it's all broken down, of course, it comes down to light. You know, when we come to appreciate that we're biocapacitors having very different kinds of experiences at different wavelengths in different dimensions simultaneously even, it all starts to come together relative to the future of how we can heal, how we can change consciousness. And, of course, you're working on that. But I had a question about, Evan, about your own experience as a neurosurgeon. I mean, here you've performed 4,000-some surgeries in your lifetime. You have this mind-blowing experience from a coma that you were in, which literally changed your worldview. But prior to that experience, didn't you have patients that ever said, hey, Dr. Alexander, I had this really weird experience during surgery, or I almost died, but let me tell you who I saw on the other side. I mean, did these things like trip you up a little bit before your own personal NDE?
Well, they would. And, you know, I would see things, especially around the time when a patient, when the physical body died and a patient left this earthly plane. And also I would hear stories from family members about after-death communications and things like that. I just had no idea how to interpret it all because before my coma, I was very much a card-toting member of the reductive materialist, you know, our conventional scientific view that if you reduce everything down to subatomic particles and then build up your knowing of those particles, atoms, molecules, cells of the brain, and everything in the physical universe, that you can explain everything there is. Now, that conventional science puts out there that none of us are truly conscious. It says that the illusion of consciousness and the illusion of free will are simply the subatomic activities of all those atoms, molecules, cells in the brain, and they create that illusion of consciousness. And my coma journey showed me very clearly that that's completely backwards, that consciousness, soul, or spirit is what absolutely exists fundamentally in this universe. It's not created by the brain at all, but it's allowed in this very limited trickle of an apparent here and now. Of course, that's what near-death experiences have been telling us forever, is that when you're freed up from the shackles of the physical brain, say at the time of death, your awareness actually becomes much greater as you encounter the souls of departed loved ones and head into these idyllic realms and encounter the divine and the infinite healing power of that unconditional love. And those things really kind of defy our understanding, especially in the ultra-real kind of presentation that we get there. Remember, you're not seeing with the eyes or hearing with the ears. At times you become other beings, an entire swaths of the whole experience as part of your learning. And it's a whole different way of experiencing and coming to know things. And that's one of the reasons it's so difficult to put into words, to try and explain to other beings here. But the good news is there are tens of millions alive today who have been to the other side and come back.
Exactly. And there's so many people. You know, I mentioned Dr. Ian Stevenson because his extraordinary, voluminous collection of children's memory of past lives, or looking at birthmarks that show up in our physical bodies from trauma in a prior body, or in geopathogenics. I mean, there's so many fields now, biogenealogy, which shows, you know, we're carriers of bloodline lineages, not just our own trauma from our own many lifetimes, but the trauma of the bloodline we deposit our body vessel into. So having had I really can't imagine what that must have been like for you as a human being, because I had a near-death experience at 3. So I've sort of lived on the fringe of the fringe my whole life. The extraordinary shift that must have happened to your worldview and change. So the love and the unconditional love is something all people describe. But you used a word I like very much when you were describing these other dimensional realities that we can tap into through a variety of methods. Near death is just one of them, and we all experience them at death, but let's hope we can experience them while we're living too. You called it hyper-real.
Yes.
I think that's a beautiful description, because it is difficult when you have these whole experiences of universal wisdom, which come as a packet of a singularity unity, to then try to hold on to the reverberation of it, first in your body, and then in your consciousness, to find words that are inadequate.
Right. Well, it is a tremendous challenge to bring it through. And, you know, as I told my older son, when I first came back from my coma, important to point out that my brain, as my doctors had predicted, my brain was wrecked. You know, when I had first gone into the emergency room in grand mal seizures and in coma, on that Monday morning, November 10th, 2008, I was already gone from this world, and my doctors at that time, given the diagnosis of gram-negative bacterial meningitis and rapid descent into coma over 3.5 hours, they knew I was down to a 10% or less chance of survival. And through a week on the ventilator, on 3 very powerful intravenous antibiotics, things only got worse. The last signs of any neocortical function, the outer surface of the brain is called the neocortex. That's the human part of the brain, and that's the part that meningitis attacks so perfectly. And, of course, that's why it makes this kind of severe meningitis a perfect model for human death.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is virtually no one returns to tell any tales because of the destruction of the human part of the brain. To this day, my doctors have no explanation for how I have recovered so fully from this. In fact, by 8 weeks after my coma, everything had come back to me, even though when I first came out of coma, everything from my life before was gone, all words and language, memories of childhood, all my religious beliefs, more than 20 years experience in neurosurgery. Every bit of that was gone when I first woke up to this world, but I knew full well where I had been deep in coma.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained it to my older son at that time, a day after I got out of the hospital, it was the day before Thanksgiving 2008, I told him it was way too real to be real. He was majoring in neuroscience in college at the time, and you know, he had gotten there that first night I was in coma, walked in the room at 11:15, and took one look at that corpse being ventilated 12 times a minute by the machine, and he knew his dad was already gone.
Mm-hmm.
But Evan was there, you know, after I did start to wake up on day 7 and came back to this world, even though my brain was very destroyed initially. A lot of that stuff came back very quickly, words and language over hours, childhood memories over a week or two, and then knowledge of all of science and 20 years experience in neurosurgery back over 8 weeks. And when I told my son there the day out of the hospital, I told Evan it was way too real to be real, he could tell I'd been transformed.
Mm-hmm.
He said there was like a light shining within me, that I was far more present than I'd ever been. And he gave me the best advice I've ever received. He told me if I wanted it to be of any value to anyone, since he knew as a neuroscience major, every time you revisit a memory, you risk changing it.
Right.
And so he advised me to write everything down that I could remember from my deep coma journey before I read anything about near-death experiences,
yeah,
physics, cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very good advice indeed, and that's what I ended up doing. I wrote about 20,000 words over 6 weeks, and that was my core baseline database. I had never really read the near-death literature before, so it was good to get all that down just so I knew my story and it wasn't confused with anyone else's story.
For sure. For sure.
And
you know, go ahead.
Into that near-death literature and was just astonished,
mm-hmm,
at the similarities going back thousands of years from all different cultures between all of these journeys. And my journey certainly serves as kind of the exception that proves the rule and validates so many of those other experiences that also validate my experience.
And make it possible for people who beforehand, you know, may have been afraid to speak their own truth and share their stories. Because
right. I think that's the biggest advantage, the value of proof of heaven and map of heaven, is they help to take the lid off and
yeah,
let people know you're not crazy. Share these stories. And also I try to help wake up the medical profession so that nurses and doctors, all those involved in healthcare, will invite people to share these stories when they've had near-death experiences, because in general, patients do not tend to share these because it's such a bizarre journey. They think people will call them crazy, but it's not crazy. The similarities show us something very fundamentally rich about our existence as human beings, and this is part of this awakening to help invite these tens of millions of journeyers to share their stories.
And also, you know, once we accept that all is consciousness and love is sort of the universal matrix that is the glue of it all, from a healthcare perspective, I remember Larry Dawsey's joined me numerous times over the last 20 years, I guess. And I remember his own story when he came to appreciate the importance of prayer and how his consciousness linked into the capacity and the potential of the soul of the person he would see, so that he couldn't not use prayer, and it changed his practice. So as you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, the healthcare profession so sorely needs to appreciate that the death sentences they give out to human beings is just unconscionable.
Right.
Because none of us are deity, though we're co-creators coming to be like gods. May we all get there. but until then, the word, thought, and deed of all of us is affecting everybody. And as a person who has been so engaged in integrative healing my whole professional and personal life since a very young age, I've always sort of been saddened by the lack of reverence so many people in the medical industry, I'd say, rather than medical profession, show towards the consciousness of the individuals with whom they are on a journey. They're not doing things to somebody, though they think they are. They're participating in the journey. Can you speak to that for a moment before we take our first break?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people I know in medicine are really waking up to seeing that we're treating beings that are physical, mental, emotional, but also very deeply spiritual. And in fact, it's really best to look at each and every one of us as eternal spiritual beings that are on this beautiful journey with our soulmates and soul groups. And in fact, you really have to step back far enough, as my journey showed me very clearly, and as the scientific literature on non-local consciousness, and as you said earlier, the work of Ian Stevenson at UVA and now Jim Tucker about past life memories in children. I mean, we're coming to have a much richer understanding of consciousness, soul, and spirit as fundamental in this universe, not created by the brain at all, but in fact allowed in, various states allowed in of this consciousness. And more in medicine are coming to realize that. So you really have to take that big step back and see each patient as part of a soul group that's part of, you know, many incarnations, and that we come here to face these difficulties and challenges in life, certainly including injuries and illness. These are gifts that allow growth of our soul if we're willing to face the hardships and show the love and compassion, forgiveness that we're here to learn.
Amen.
A lot
to all of that
are coming to see that much grander scope of healing.
Yeah, and it's so nice to see, because it's always been, as I mentioned, in indigenous peoples' medicine and in shamanism and in Ayurvedic medicine and in so many traditional acupuncture, there's been this awareness that, thank God, the Western world is coming out of nursery school. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Evan Alexander, The Map of Heaven, How Science, Religion, and Ordinary People Are Proving the Afterlife. For those in the Maryland, Virginia, D.C. area, Dr. Evan Alexander will be speaking from 8:30 to 12:15 p.m. at the Stella Maris Auditorium at 2300 Delaney Valley Road in Timonium, Maryland. And that's on Tuesday, November 11th. It's being sponsored by the Sisters of Mercy Stella Maris, and the cost is $30. Again, that's Tuesday, November 11th from 8:30 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. And then when we come back, I'll tell you about his evening presentation on that same date.
Hello, this is Dr. Raymond Moody, and I am a psychiatrist and philosophy professor, and you are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zoe Hieronymus. please listen to this program. I've been inspired by Zoe's work for many years.
Thank you, Brother Raymond. Last laugh. Oh, he's done such a beautiful job all these decades with the psychomantium, etc. Dr. Eben Alexander is our current guest. His book, The Map of Heaven, How Science, Religion, and Ordinary People Are Proving the Afterlife. It's a Simon & Schuster 2014. You all will love this book. It's a beautiful book to read. Dr. Alexander is speaking in Baltimore Tuesday, November 11th, two times, in the morning from 8:30 to 12:15 p.m. at the Stella Maris Auditorium. That's at 2300 Delaney Valley Road in Timonium. It's sponsored by a beautiful group of people, Sisters of Mercy, Stella Maris. The cost is $30. And then in the evening at the 17th Annual St. Louis Mary Battle RSM Lecture on Proof of Heaven from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. It's free. It's at the Mercy High School, 1300 East Northern Parkway in Baltimore, also part of Stella Maris's community outreach program. The reception begins at 6 p.m. and Eben's lecture begins at 7 p.m. If you're not in a place to write any of that down, remember the name of our guest, Eben, E-B-E-N, Alexander.com/events. That's Eben, E-B-E-N, Alexander.com/events. So, Eben, given that you have had this sort of sea change of a new paradigm for you, and you're now part of a really consciously aware movement planet-wide of moving towards unity consciousness. That's been my experience over this 30 years of covering the new paradigm, whether it's a geologist or a psychologist or somebody who does past life therapy or somebody who's doing cryptozoology. Everybody is coming to the exact same place of awareness as you point out, which is that we are all one. And that when any one of us suffers, we all suffer. And that when any one of us masters our own being, we improve the world. Talk to us a bit about the power of thought from your own experience, both in your near-death experience and since now that you're involved in consciousness-related studies.
Well, I think it's important to point out that, as I said earlier, consciousness is really the only thing any one of us truly knows to exist. Our conventional neuroscience would remind us that everything that we ever have experienced, whether it be a lovely sunset or a beautiful symphony or falling in love or watching autumn colors or what have you, every experience we've ever been through, every emotion, every memory, every little bit of it is nothing more than the flickering of 100 billion neurons in a 3-pound gelatinous mass in a warm, dark bath. I mean, that's what that neuroscience would try and tell you. Now, the important thing to realize about that is it really is pointing out the fundamental place of consciousness in all of our human experience. And yet the science that I worshipped before my coma, that reductive materialist science, brain creates consciousness of birth to death and nothing more, and also that conventional neuroscience would proudly say none of us have free will at all, that we're just automatons.
We're synapsing. we're simply synapse machines.
Yeah, that we're simply big, multi-neuronal synapse machines.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. And my coma journey showed me very clearly that that is completely wrong, that in fact consciousness is what runs all of this. Consciousness, soul, or spirit is what runs all of this unfolding reality. It runs the brain and all of the physical world. And this, of course, is where that revolution in science that I mentioned a little while ago is headed, is away from those simplistic models that fail completely, that say that the brain creates consciousness, to ones that are far richer and, in fact, much more open to coming to better solutions, say, in the interpretation of the enigma of quantum mechanics, or trying to address what's called the hard problem of consciousness, which is really a statement out there that points out that in spite of the kind of assumption in our modern science that the brain creates consciousness, that there's not a soul on earth who studies the brain and mind and neuroscience and all that who can even give you one sentence about the how the physical brain might relate to consciousness. And that is a very deep and vexing conundrum. But the good news is, you know, you don't have to just throw your hands up in the air. There actually are some answers in the scientific pipeline that help us to explain it in the form of the filter theory.
Yeah.
Where the brain is a reducing valve or a transmitter.
A translator,
creator, you know,
yeah. No, exactly, and that's why I've always appreciated the much bigger time scales in the Hindu tradition, in particular, where we talk about the Brahma in trillions of years, not hundreds, not thousands. That the sense of time of being linear has really put us in this mousetrap of thinking that if we just keep spinning our wheel, we're going to get better. But the cyclical sense of time takes into consideration not just how an individual soul experiences this very short duration of having a physical vessel, but that there are civilizations already that can put on a vessel and take a vessel off the same way we do today our coats in our closet.
Right, exactly. And it's important to point out that, you know, this physical body is so much less than what we truly, really are as eternal spiritual beings. And we can be far grander than that very limited trickle of consciousness in the apparent here and now that we feel on this side of the veil. And this is why in Map of Heaven it's such a clarion call for meditation. And for people who want to deeply get into some of these truths, you can do that. As I often say in my talks, you don't have to die or almost die or have an after-death communication or something to really get the reality of this and the fundamental role of consciousness, soul, and spirit. By being a conscious being, we can all go in and do that. And that's why I do that work with Sacred Acoustics that I talk about in the appendix to Map of Heaven. The appendix is entitled "The Answers Lie Within Us All," and that's because I fully believe that they do. And this deep meditation, and for me that's a form of centering prayer, even when I use the Sacred Acoustics kind of sound enhancement to get into deep meditative states, it's a form of centering prayer that comes right back into the presence of that infinitely healing and overwhelmingly unconditionally loving deity at the core of all that exists. And being able to use that energy is kind of a healing energy, because we're all in the process of healing just by being incarnate in these physical forms and being here with our soulmates and soul groups. And it's all about learning those lessons that I talked about earlier that have to do with overcoming the hardships and difficulties in this life, certainly including illness and injury. So that my role as a healer now is stepping back and taking a far grander view of what each and every soul is going through with their soul groups, here to teach and learn those lessons of unconditional love. And they do have infinite power to heal. That's why that unconditional love is so important. And, of course, that's the thing that the vast majority of people who have had these spiritually transformative experiences, that's what they bring back. That's what they talk about, is the power of that love and of that deity that goes beyond all naming, that's at the core.
And as you and
meditation will help us get there.
And as you and others and people who have come to you with their stories, and the many people our listeners have heard over the decades, is that this similarity of love, this feeling totally accepted, fully empowered, purposeful awareness, clarity of sense of individuality as connected to the all. And it's the thing that strikes me about those intradimensional spaces that our soul is always part of. And I'm a student of Kabbalah, and that's what I teach. And there's like five different parts of the soul. And there's a scientific literature of Kabbalah. It's like a science. It's interesting because everybody's experience points to this extraordinary feeling of being at peace. And peace is, of course, the greatest blessing there is, and we struggle with it individually, collectively, as a nation, as a world. When you tap in to that core of love, can you start to remember some of the things that you had in your near-death experience that kind of fade a little bit over time?
Well, actually, those memories, the memories of the experience do not fade. They're very, very powerful. And in fact, that's one of the biggest clues that they are not a hallucination or a drug effect or confabulation or dream state, is the fact that these memories from a near-death experience are so persistent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll have people come up and share stories with me about near-death experiences they had after I give a presentation. They often come up and say, well, I never told anybody this, but. And then they'll often share a story that when you come to see the truth and the reality behind it, it could change this world. And that story might come from 50 or 60 years ago.
Exactly.
But they remember it as if it happened yesterday.
Exactly.
It's that fear. And so for me, yes, I can use meditation, and I use the sacred acoustics sound boosting of my deep meditative states and centering prayer, not only to re-access memories from my deep coma journey, but actually to go back in those realms and with those same guides and that same incredibly, ineffable, indescribable deity of pure and infinite love and light at the core of all being. And this is something that all can come to do, but it's, through this meditation, for me, I recommend it be a daily practice. I try to meditate an hour or two a day, and more if I can, more if I have time. And I've been doing that for several years, and it does get better and better. And certainly accessing those realms very fully I can do, but it took me a few years of really hard work to do that reliably. So deep meditation, of course, meditators have been telling us this forever.
Yeah, as I tell people,
get a tremendous clue to get in there.
Get in the bathtub. it's the shortcut. I've just given the shortcut. No, seriously, if you get in water, near water, in the bathtub is a really easy way for people who feel they just can't get out of their own way to fall into the visual, the sensorial that's beyond the physical senses. Because, our aptitudes through our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouth, these are like the seven gateways to the soul that the soul experiences through the physical body. And we have some traditions that have so diminished the glory that's in our senses to thinking that somehow or other the body's the enemy rather than the temple for the soul while we're here temporarily.
Right.
But I want to come to the sacred acoustics and vibrational work. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of the people you've mentioned, Gary Schwartz and Larry Dawsey and Dean Radin. I mean, pretty much that we're all part of this soul group, as you point out, and I have experienced that my whole life. And it's been a beautiful thing, even though I've rarely met anybody in person. I never feel that we need to. It's like, like this conversation. We have a conversation, and then it adds to the amplitude of the carrier wave, which is really a resonance. So when we when we look to where medicine is going, where even space travel, when I chanced to interview John Allen, I think it was his name, one of the astronauts, I said, well, do you guys ever talk about consciousness being the ship and we're just going to use our consciousness to move the Earth around? And he said, oh, yeah, we do. And I was relieved to hear that it's not just Edgar Mitchell and some of these other old timers who really appreciate that.
Some of the new guys, too.
Yes, exactly. So I had a peculiar question for you, and I hope you're not offended by it. Do you have an interest now in UFOs and abductees and people claiming to be actually journeying into future technologies?
Well, I do. And I must say one of the real joys of my journey is I get to meet lots of very interesting people and from all walks of life. And that can certainly include the many, many out there that have had near-death and shared death experiences and that kind of thing. I also did get to meet Edgar Mitchell.
Oh, wonderful.
I got to visit him and stay with him in Florida several times, and it's been a real gift because he was he is a beautiful visionary.
True.
And I love the books that he's written about his journey. Of course, he was the one who started the Institute of Noetic Sciences.
Exactly.
After that incredible experience he had on Apollo 14 coming back from the moon. And he's just such a gentle soul and a beautiful messenger. And, of course, he does also share some of those kind of stories from the Apollo missions. There were things going on in that world that I think are still very much beyond our understanding and certainly suggest very strongly that we're close to a first contact on kind of a global basis with beings from other worlds. And, of course, the Pope, Pope Francis, just recently mentioned all this from the Catholic Church's viewpoint. And it's kind of a no-brainer to anybody who realizes how grand and tremendous this universe is, that, of course, there must be other life, other civilizations throughout. I had a very strong sense of that on my journey, and it really is about, I think, our joining that much bigger club. I think that's a big part of why this world is awakening now. We cannot join that much bigger club of this universe and of much grander consciousness if we come at it as a warring civilization.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this is really the time for us to grow up and mature, and I think that that is why this world is waking up as it is. And that's a big part of what I go into in the book Map of Heaven, is really taking that broad view, going back to Plato and Aristotle and to some of the Eastern and Western mystics and prophets going back thousands of years, and then building up through the scientists of the last 400 years and the rise of natural sciences, and especially the heyday of the 20th century and the successes of our modern science and technology, but also with that ugly underbelly of the associated modern warfare and thoughtless homicide and suicide, destruction of our ecosystem, threatening with extinction something like a third of the mammalian and avian and reptilian species on Earth because of the activities of that technology, really unbridled from human spirit. And so we really have to grow up at this point and realize that kind of the status quo of the scientific breakthroughs of the 20th century, with all the damage that was also caused, cannot go on. It's a non-sustainable situation. And I believe that's why we are waking up now. And part of that thinking is that it's inevitable that we will be meeting civilizations far more advanced than we are. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I think that's a big part of this kind of cosmic destiny that I point out in the Map of Heaven.
Well, and also as you show the Dogon tribe, the Cherokee, I mean, when you look to the traditions of the Earth, they speak to their ancestors off-planet. And when we look at these extraordinary cycles of time I mentioned and can find evidence of humanoid civilization that goes back 2.5 billion years of these spheres that they found in Africa, I mean, that Michael Cremo's done such a beautiful job with others to show that the entire way we think of ourselves has put us in this prison of mind control. And I think, Eben, that one of the major changes is this notion of duality that we have been saddled with, and this expectation that we have to always choose between Republican, I'm just as an example, Republican or Democrat. Well, how about Republican and Democrat? How about this and that versus this or that? It's not life or death. It's life and death. And I think this Western materialist concept of duality was a very deliberate fostering by church and other empire buildings. You know, there's an interesting reality when the British Empire took us away from our galactic center. Up until about the 1600s, every civilization on Earth used the Orion star system, which points to the galactic center, as their measuring device for where we build our civilizations, how we placed our holy centers, when we had our rituals. And then since the 1600s, when it went to the Greenwich Meridian in England, which does not have the same significance galactically, we lost our cosmic orientation. And then the other thing I recognized when I was writing my own book on the future of human experience is that when the church took us off the lunar calendar, and Jose Arguelles had argued this his whole life prior to his passing, that if we would just get back in touch with the tide of our own being and the tide and rhythm of the cosmos, which is like our own lunar landscape here on Earth, that our very DNA would be in rapport with the cosmic influence that's always feeding us, whether it's through our food or the light we breathe in or encounters like we're having. And so I think that these, you know, when people say, oh, well, so what? We lost the lunar calendar. So what? We lost the cosmic center. This is what orients a consciousness, is the patterns we're related to. And I'm sorry I took so long to say that, but I think it's a really important important addition that we have gotten rid of some of the sacred heirlooms that civilizations passed down.
Something that I hope this awakening of concerns is bringing a lot of that back. And, and I see that science and spirituality strengthen each other tremendously. That is the science that I see emerging now, the science that is greatly expanded and mature beyond the simplistic reductive materialist science that is so one-dimensional that I worship before my coma. And I'm so heartened to see how our scientific boundaries are expanding tremendously. A lot of it is in response to that enigma of quantum mechanics and also to the hard problem of consciousness. Coming to realize that the brain does not create consciousness is opening us up to a far grander view of who we are and where this is all headed. And interesting that you bring up time, because, of course, one thing you realize on these journeys is I was very aware of what I call deep time, a causality and kind of a flow of events that has to do with kind of the much grander scale of evolution, kind of along the lines of Teilhard de Chardin and his view of consciousness is evolving throughout this universe. And we are all part of that process. But in many ways, a deeper understanding of all this about the nature of consciousness is going to involve a complete reworking of our notions of space, time, mass, and energy. I saw very clearly that deep time, a much more fundamental causality that's apparent in the ascendance of our souls, when you take those steps back and see each one of us as kind of like the threads of a beautiful tapestry with multiple incarnations interwoven with our soul groups and all the lessons we're here to learn and teach with each other. And seeing it in that much bigger standpoint and seeing that time flow as we see it here in our Earth time is a very limited and kind of artificial time flow. I mean, it's something that even Einstein, although, you know, he was part of the whole quantum mechanical revolution, you know, Erwin Schrodinger, Sir James Jeans, Werner Heisenberg, de Broglie, all of these brilliant thinkers in early quantum mechanics were driven into mysticism because of the measurement problem that basically said you cannot separate the observing mind from the observed.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's a crucial part of understanding that consciousness is fundamental in this universe. But as we get deeper and deeper into a better understanding of that and of that deep time and of the different levels of causality and of temporal relationships and this ascendance of souls and in the purpose of our being here, we start to realize we're going to have to completely revise our concepts of time flow in this realm, in the earthly realm. And I think that's where materialist science is deeply into contributing to all of this effort as they expand to try and address the mysteries of quantum mechanics and unite that with relativity, whether it be through string theory or quantum gravity. I mean, it's really all about having to rework our fundamental concepts of time flow and causality themselves. And this is something I get into in the Map of Heaven. And it's part of the scientific revolution and awakening that's happening today.
Amen to all of that. It's so much fun to listen to somebody who's so excited about all of these things. I love you for that. Evan Alexander's our guest. His book, I'm not going to tell you, because third caller right now, who knows, will be a winner of it. And we'll be right back. You can find more at Eben Alexander, E-B-E-N, Alexander.com. He will be in Baltimore Tuesday, November 11th, both at Stella Maris Auditorium from 8:30 to 12:15 in the morning. And in the evening, he will be at the Mercy High School at 1300 East Northern Parkway from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., which is free. Learn more at Eben, E-B-E-N, Alexander.com.
Hello, I am Amit Goswami, author of The Self-Aware Universe and How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization. And we're listening to 21st Century Radio with Zohara Hieronymus. It's a wonderful show of the new paradigm that is going on right now.
Brother Amit, what a wonderful journeyman. He is always so inspiring and has helped so many people appreciate that we are one. As I like to say, Eben, we're all together or we're all together.
We are all together, and that recognizing that oneness of consciousness, and not just about humans and not just about all life on Earth, but we're all part of a far grander consciousness, and that's what I think we're awakening to now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I said before the break, your enthusiasm is just beautiful, and it's a lovely thing. You know, when somebody comes along, for those of us that have been in the trenches for so long, trying to bring joy to the topic, when sometimes people say, well, it just sounds like a bunch of words. And then somebody comes along with a personal experience that is very bright. Let me put it that way. And
well,
go ahead.
Beautiful to share it. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
And I appreciate all of you who have been in the trenches for many decades. I think if Proof of Heaven had come out 15 years ago, it would have hit a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to a lot of brilliant sages like you and others who have been carrying the banner to wake this world up, the world is ready.
No question about it. No, you know, it's funny because I used to be a whistleblower and I covered foreign affairs and global politics for a decade. And I used to say, you know, don't worry about terrorism, folks. People having temper tantrums, they want attention. It's going to bring the world together. And I said, don't worry about earth changes, folks. The silver lining is it's going to bring the world together. And sometimes it's through, unfortunately, our suffering as individuals or humans or a nation or civilization that we grow versus, as you rightly and many others point out who are journeyers, to grow from joy is the choice we also have.
Uh-huh.
Speak to that for us.
Well, I think that is very true, and it's really about bringing that unconditional love, which I came to see on my journey. It was clear to me that this is not like a battle between good and evil, that evil might somehow win, but in fact that the darkness and apparent evil are simply the absence of that love, that infinite unconditional love and its tremendous power to heal. And by serving as conduits for that energy of that love of the Creator for the creation, we can each bring that infinitely powerful love into this world, and that is what will heal,
mm-hmm.
you know, the individual, the soul group, ethnic and national groups, all of humanity, all of life on Earth and beyond. That unconditional love does have infinite power to heal, and I think that's something we're all coming to recognize.
Amen. It really is the bottom line, is that we're all here to serve. We're all here to be part of that loving matrix of the cosmos. And one of the things that you bring also to the discussion is this capacity of analysis, which not everybody in this work has, because some are very heart-centered and they can take you into the world through technology, but not necessarily share it with others. We have about a minute left, and I'd like you to share your own involvement with either the studies in Virginia or elsewhere using vibration to change consciousness.
Well, this is all work that we're doing with several groups to look at, in particular, the sacred acoustics and the tones that we use. And I describe a bit in Proof of Heaven and more extensively in the appendix to Map of Heaven, that appendix entitled The Answers Lie Within Us All, how I believe that these differential sound tones are able to free up our conscious awareness and allow us to slip behind the veil and get a much deeper feeling of that infinite consciousness that is allowed in such a limited form in our kind of normal waking state. And so I urge people to learn more about that kind of meditation and how that can apply to centering prayer. And it's work that we're doing with various groups at certain academic institutions, not only at University of Virginia, but University of Arizona, where they also have some consciousness focus that's very strong. But
it's
all about trying to bring tools to this world to allow people to meditate more deeply. And that little voice in our head.
I got to tell people to follow up with you. EbenAlexander.com. Visit him online or in town.
Stimulating talk around the clock. And breaking news now. On Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.